Tonight's Reformation Society meeting on churches under fire. We try to deal with things directly pertaining to church within history or contemporary, and also over the last year also been linking up with journalism that is often neglected, the story that's often not being printed by the world's media, and therefore we named it after the journalist most closely associated with David Livingstone, and whom I would say was the greatest journalist, not just of the 19th century, but maybe of all time. So what's the biggest news of the last week? Well, without a shadow of a doubt, the burning of the Cathedral of Notre Dame. Now, many people may think, well, what's the big thing about this? Isn't the Eiffel Tower a bigger structure? Well, yes, but the Eiffel Tower doesn't get as many visitors every year as the Notre Dame. Eiffel Tower's only been standing about 120 years. Notre Dame's been standing more than 800 years. The disastrous Monday the 15th of April burning of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris leads to many questions and very serious implications. That's very relevant for us today, especially in this Holy Week, this Easter week, as we're heading into Good Friday and Resurrection Sunday. Notre Dame de Paris, French for Our Lady of Paris, was built between 1863 and 1260, about 100 years to build. And they only finished all different aspects by about 1345. It's the most famous Gothic building in the world. No other building represents France quite like Notre Dame. It's been the most visited monument in France, without doubt the most famous Gothic building in the world. The Church of Notre Dame receives 13 million visitors a year, or has. Just the roof alone took 1,200 oak trees, representing 21 hectares of forest. Now, in the 800 years it's existed, it's only really been damaged during the French Revolution. The French Revolution caused tremendous havoc, and at one point it was desecrated. During the anti-Christian fanaticism of the French Revolution, Notre Dame was hijacked and turned into a temple of reason, dedicated to atheistic cult of reason, that actually took a well-known prostitute and enthroned as the goddess of reason, and enthroned her in the cathedral, and it turned the cathedral into a cult of reason temple. That's their term, cult of reason. Later, the Committee of Public Safety, run by Robespierre, determined to turn it into a warehouse. At one stage, they literally took 28 statues of biblical kings and had them all guillotined. They beheaded, we'll see those pictures later on, of the West Wall's biblical kings. Beheaded statues. It was Napoleon Bonaparte who restored the cathedral to the Catholic Church in 1801. In 1804, Napoleon was crowned the Emperor of France, the first person in 800 years to bear the title Emperor of France. And he was crowned, well, kind of by the Pope, but Pope Pius VII handed Napoleon the crown, and Napoleon crowned himself because he thought no one was able to crown him. And Napoleon, for his credit, restored the church back, the cathedral back to being used for church property and so on. And we know about the French Revolution and France quite a lot from Charles Dickens' classic A Tale of Two Cities, but many of us may also know about Victor Hugo's The Hunchback of Notre Dame. The Hunchback of Notre Dame was actually written specifically to save Notre Dame. And Victor Hugo was asked by a major architect to save Notre Dame, which was decaying and falling and crumbling through neglect. And so he wrapped this novel, Hunchback of Notre Dame, putting magnificent descriptions about all the grandeurs and the history and so on of this cathedral, wrapped it around a story. And through this, millions of people worldwide and in France came to love Notre Dame and made it such a great tourist attraction. And the French king, Louis Philippe, in 1844, determined to restore the cathedral. So the book was published in 1831, and within 12 years, it had led the king to say, we're going to restore Notre Dame to its original glory. So there's a book that saved a cathedral. All right, well, let's get on with this war against God. Europe became Christendom. Hard missionary work, lots of battles and fights. Kings like King Alfred the Great rallied the Christian force against the pagans. And you can go to a place like Lindisfarne, as I've been, and you'll see the ruins. But even these ruins have a story to tell of Christian churches that were damaged in the Viking raids and plundered. But it shows that Europe was built on them. And even the Vikings came to Christ. And so you've got these magnificent Viking churches, the stave churches, which testify how the Vikings even were won to Christ. And throughout Europe, you can see many images in the monuments showing the Christian roots of Europe. Some of the senior laws, such as the Common Laws of England, the Magna Carta, the Great Charter, and, of course, the Bibles and books and constitutions. There's a great literary heritage, but it's not just in books, which is, of course, my great interest and our mission's great focus is literature, but it's also in architecture. You can tell a lot about a people by the buildings they make. And you can see so often the church cathedral was the highest point dominating, like this is St. Michael in France. And, of course, Florence, you can see the Great Dome. And someplace it's very unambiguously Christian. And wherever you go, in the Alps of Switzerland and Austria and Germany, you can see the churches dominating the valleys. And everything is built around. And the spire is meant to direct your eyes up towards heaven and the cross, proclaiming the supremacy of Christ, the sovereignty of Christ, King of Kings and Lord of Lords over all area of life. And for centuries, well, more than a millennium, the tallest building in Europe and tallest in all of the world was the cathedral's spires. And until about 100 years ago, nothing would have been taller than the cathedrals. This is Neuschwanstein in Bavaria, one of the great castles. And this is Salzburg, where my wife comes from. This is the actual Salzburg, Salt Mountain castle. You can see it's called the City of Churches. There's churches all over the place. I think something like 50 churches in little Salzburg. And, you know, Sound of Music, the hills are alive with the sound of music and all that. And you can see throughout Europe, churches dominate the landscape. Even sometimes they've been crowded in and hemmed in by so much else, but although the churches used to have a lot of space around them, they often hemmed in, but still they dominated the landscape. Salisbury Cathedral, Wells Cathedral, so many great, magnificent cathedrals. Westminster Abbey, directly opposite from the Palace of Westminster, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And Canterbury, the seat of the Archbishop of England, of Church of England in Canterbury. And Notre Dame, of course. Now, one should say some things about Notre Dame. Notre Dame, when they started to build it, this was the first example of Gothic architecture. And Gothic architecture is all about lifting your eyes upwards and to make you feel infinitesimal, to feel insignificant in the scheme of things, to walk in and be overwhelmed by a building that declares the grandeur and the glory and the majesty of God. And because God is great, people built these buildings. And remember, these buildings took over 100 years to build. Cathedrals took 100 to 150 or more years to build. And these flying buttresses, which were specifically to enable them to go higher than ever before. And you can see the rose windows, which they've got four, east, west, north, south. And the tall spire. By the way, the spire collapsed a few times over the years. And this one was built in the 1700s. That's the one that collapsed now. At the top of the spire, notice the cross. In the cathedral, they've got a pipe organ dating back to the 18th century. It's the largest in France. And it has five keyboards, 109 stops, and 7,374 pipes. In 1990s, the organ was restored. It cost $2 million to restore to restore the organ, and it took 40,000 man hours to do the restoration of the pipe organ in the 1990s. That's just one part of the church. The organ is only a small part of the church. And you go around Europe and you can see churches dominate the landscape. Anyone recognize where this church would be? This is where we're going to be in July. It's Grossmünster, the great cathedral in Zurich, where Ulrich Zwingli launched the Protestant Reformation. So throughout Europe, you can see, even when you get to Moscow, you can't help but see the churches dominate the landscape. Even 7 years of atheism couldn't wipe out the architectural testimony that Christianity is the foundation of civilization. St. Basil's Cathedral in Russia, at one time the only church left open in Moscow. 50,000 church buildings were closed by the communists between 1917 and 1941. 50,000. They killed over 150,000 ministers, clergy, shot dead. They destroyed so many churches, monasteries. There wasn't one single theological college, Bible college, monastery, or mission station all of Russia. In the whole Russian Empire, Soviet Union, there were only less than 200 congregations left by 1941 when Operation Barbarossa was launched. This church was turned into a stable. It's been wonderfully restored. Just one of many examples. Even in cities where the densification has been so intense, you still get these churches rising up out of the chaos of the city. And the windows. And bear in mind, these cathedrals were built during the Dark Ages. While the rest of the world was living in mud huts and thatched roofs and so on, Europe was suffering in the Dark Ages. And what did they do during Dark Ages? Well, they built hospitals, schools, universities, and cathedrals. And stained glass windows. This stained glass window is 700 years old. It goes back to 1300. And the Dark Ages produced this. You may wonder, where did they get the time and the energy and the money to build these cathedrals? The answer is given to us by Stephen Mitford Goodson, who was the director of the Sovereign Reserve Bank for about 9 years, I think. He's written a book, Inside the Sovereign Reserve Bank, Whistleblower. Not surprising he lost his job. And then he produced A History of Central Banking and Enslavement of Mankind, and a whole lot of other great books too. But in it, he points out that Europe in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries had a superabundance of time, money, and of food, that they were able to put so much of the energies into building these spectacular cathedrals. Why? You only had to work about 140 days a year in Europe in the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries. Why? Well, usury was banned. Bankers were not allowed to charge interest on loans and things like this, in accordance with the Bible and Magna Carta, for example. That's the biggest emphasis of Magna Carta, 1215, the grandfather of all bills of rights. Banking, usury, interest rates are completely forbidden. And so the people of Europe had something like 220 days off as holidays a year on average. And so massive amounts of time and energy went to building these cathedrals to the glory of God, just celebrating the amount of free time and free energy and creativity they had, which has not been matched in any other time in history. It's the one time in history when Jewish bankers were banished from the lands. You're not allowed to have any usury, and you're not allowed to charge interest. And so the people had a lot of time money. It's pointed out today that most of our money, gets stolen through taxation, inflation, and corruption. You are paying, when you go to the petrol tank, you are putting more money into the government than you're putting into the petrol company, the oil supplier, and the actual petrol station that you're going to. Most of the money, more than 60% of every litre's price, goes to government taxes, levies, and everything else. And just imagine that. You can buy petrol in Botswana half the price it costs in South Africa. And Botswana is a landlocked country, a long way from the coast, if you've noticed. They get the oil shipped to them from us. And they can charge half the price we charge per litre in Botswana. Just showing one example. Not saying Botswana doesn't have taxes, but they're not as extreme as ours. But just the amount of tax and rates. And just take how Cape Town, for example, is paying 4 times more taxes than gets spent in our province. So we are putting $200 billion into the public treasury by taxes every year, and they spend about $49 billion back here. Most of that's on corruption, BBB, EE, affirmative action, and all their jobs for their pals and so on. But still, if the Western Cape went independent, we could cut our taxes to a quarter. Actually, if we got rid of the corruption, we could cut it down to 10%. Stephen Goodson was convinced that we could bring our taxes down to under 1%. total, all taxes combined, under 1% of the total income, and we could cover all legitimate necessary needs of government. That we're being looted. In fact, this is, of course, what's going on all over the world, is the looting. But the cathedrals are not only pointing it to God, they're pointing it to a time when they didn't have usury. And what a spectacular testimony these churches are. By the way, this church, church at Cologne, was bombed to pieces in the Second World War. They built it to the original specs. Now, we know that there's a big clash between Islam and Christianity. And we know that churches are under fire in Africa. Just take northern Nigeria. In the last, well, let's say since 2001, in the last 18 years, there have been over 65,000 people, Christians, killed in northern Nigeria. Just between 2010 and 2015, that's in 5 years, just in 5 years, Muslims killed 17,000 Christians and destroyed or attacked 1,000 churches in northern Nigeria alone. Just in northern Nigeria. Now, I took this picture in Jos. Islam is peace. Islam is the best. This is on the side of a church with bullet holes and so on. And, well, I think that's very descriptive. I mean, nothing demonstrates peace more than bombing and burning thousands of churches. In Somalia, they don't have any churches. They destroyed all the churches before the Americans went in 1993. But they do have some Christians. And this is a Somali Christian, one of 12 that we know who were buried up to their waist and stoned to death. Pictures posted on the internet by Muslims in Somalia, which is 99.9% Muslim. Even Kenya gets stones and grenades thrown through their windows. No country in Africa suffered more at the hands of Muslims than Egypt. Christians were the majority for 1,000 years in Egypt, planted by Saint Mark. But they are bombed, attacked. Arson attacks in Egypt is so common. There was something in a region of 75 churches destroyed in one weekend by Hosni Mubarak's army was protecting them for 26 years, soldiers 24 hours a day outside every church in the country. But with the Arab Spring of Barack Hussein Obama removing this pro-Christian leader, they then brought in this Muslim Brotherhood and they, Morsi, and they murdered Christians by the bucketful. Every single week there would be funerals, and this is St. Mark's Cathedral in Akara, the head of the Coptic Church in Egypt, and they're under siege regularly, and regularly they have funeral services for martyrs, Christians murdered for their faith by the Muslim Brotherhood, which Hillary Clinton called a force for peace and moderation and stability in the Middle East when she was Secretary of State. The Christians there have suffered car bombs outside churches, kidnapping, murders, and it is persecution. And there is no doubt whatsoever that it's genocide. There's an attempt to destroy the Christians in Egypt. The Christians in Egypt, the Copts, were the majority for 1,000 years. Even for 500 years after Muslims took over Egypt, Christians were still a majority. Today, they're 12% of the population of Egypt. 12% of Egypt are Christians. And their language, Coptic, is now only used in their churches and their homes. The official language is the colonial language of the Arabs. I mean, Arabic is the language of Saudi Arabia. And so, to bear in mind, Egypt is colonized. They are now a minority in their own country. And nobody has done more damage to the church in Egypt than Barack Hussein Obama. The American policy that led to the Arab Spring, which was a Christian winter, was catastrophic. And as for America's liberation of Iraq, the people in Iraq were living in some of the highest standards of living in the whole of the Middle East under Saddam Hussein, who was meant to be a terrible dictator. But all of Saddam Hussein's bodyguards were Christians, and all of his cooks and chefs were Christians, because he knew Christians don't assassinate. And he couldn't trust fellow Muslims because they might assassinate him. I mean, he was a dictator. So he got all of his bodyguards from the Christians. In fact, if you go downtown to Baghdad, you get to the Baptist Church in Baghdad, and they've got a massive organ, gift of His Excellency the President Saddam Hussein. His bodyguards came from that Baptist Church. And he knew that they it was in their interest to keep him alive, and they did. And there were 1.3 million Christians in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. Today there's not even 100,000 left. They've lost 1.2 million. Most fled, many have been killed, many have been beheaded. And this is just one of many churches in Baghdad bombed by the Muslim radicals who now flourish because they no longer have the dictator to keep them in place. It is genocide. What do you call when a people get destroyed in whole or in part, where they go from being the majority in the country to being the minority in their own country, like in Egypt and in Iraq? The Christians there date back to the first century. They received the gospel from the apostles. But Barack Hussein Obama was happy to fiddle while the whole of the Middle East burned. In 8 years, he had war. He bombed 8 times more countries than George Bush, but he got a Nobel Peace Prize for it. Lowest economy, economic growth in American history, record number of mass shootings, record number of people on food stamps, welfare, record high health insurance costs, record high national debt, worst rioting since 1967, highest poverty level in American history. This is what they call a success. And what he did to America is nothing compared to what he did to the Middle East. By the Americans destabilizing and destroying the stable governments of Libya and Syria and Egypt, they created this tsunami of millions and millions and millions of refugees who've poured into Europe, creating another whole series of problems. Just take Syria, which used to be one of the most stable countries in the Middle East. The three countries in the Middle East that have the most Christians, Egypt, followed by Iraq and Syria. Well, Egypt's gotten destabilized horribly. There's probably over 2 million Christians from Egypt that have fled the country since the Arab Spring. But the chaos caused in Iraq has been even more devastating. I mean, they've lost 90-something percent of all the Christians in Iraq have fled or been killed. But in Syria, you've had a stable country with 6% of population Christians. In fact, some beautiful churches. And they lived under complete religious freedom under Assad. So Assad, you can see this beautiful church. This is what it looks like now, thanks to American-funded ISIS. ISIS terrorists have bludgeoned, bayoneted, bombed, and beheaded all the way across the Middle East. And the first thing they've done when they get to a church in Syria, get rid of the Christian cross and replace with the ISIS flag. What has this got to do with the attack on Notre Dame? Everything. We know in Africa, and they know in the Middle East, what it's like to have Muslim majority moving in. They destroy, they kill so many people. This is a picture that I was sent from Syria. Notice how many soldiers are wearing the Syrian army uniform in this church. Why? The Christians are disproportionately highly represented in the Syrian army. Why? Because they know the only thing standing between them and being beheaded, bayoneted, and bombed, and their churches being destroyed, and their wives and daughters being enslaved in Muslim slave markets, is Assad's secular government that protects them from the Islamic radicals. So America screams blue murder, Saddam Hussein's a dictator! Assad's a dictator. Well, in the Middle East, you can't have anything else. Do you want a Muslim democracy, which becomes an Islamic dictatorship, or do you want a sort of secular state that keeps the radicals from killing their neighbors? And America's determination to bomb people into democracy, well, all the Christians and every single missionary I know in Syria and Iraq are 100% for Saddam Hussein in the past or for Assad now, and 100% against American foreign policy, because they're destabilizing Christian countries or countries where Christians can be kept safe. Assad, the vicious, evil dictator of Syria, has many Christian friends. In fact, you can see all the church leaders, represents the different denominations, meeting with Assad. You can see Christians marching in the street with his pictures. This is a bit embarrassing for the dictatorship propaganda. And not only that, but here he is in Easter. He'll be in the churches, Easter and Christmas, and the Christians taking selfie with him and thinking, where's his security? He's meant to be this horrible, evil dictator. By the way, he's British trained and he's a medical doctor. But anyway, if this is what Syria, what Damascus looks like under Assad. Yep, this is the wicked, evil dictatorship of Assad in Syria. But these are the liberators, ISIS. So how come ISIS has brought American-style democracy, destroying whole towns and villages like this? Well, it's been admitted now. This is no longer a conspiracy theory. It's a fact admitted in the American Congress. Even the American Vice President Biden, Vice President under Barack Hussein Obama, admitted, as did the Chief of Staff of the U.S. military, to the Congress, yes, well, it's true, we did start ISIS. ISIS was started by the American CIA. We fund them, we train them, we equip them. In fact, Ambassador Stevens, the man who died in Baghdad at the hands of these creeps, he gave them the first $500 million. He was the bagman who took from Qatar $500 million cash to al-Bukhari, who was locked up by the Americans under Bush. And in the first week that Barack Hussein Obama was in power, he ordered this al-Bukhari released. And al-Bukhari went straight out with us $500 million from Ambassador Stevens from Qatar and started ISIS. And ISIS went out and beheaded Christians all over the Middle East, bombed churches, caused absolute havoc. Nobody has beheaded more people than Saudi Arabia and ISIS. And ISIS goes around graveyards where British war cemeteries in the Middle East. These are people who fought, for example, the First World War there, smashing the graves of Christians. But that's not all. They destroy the graves of the prophets. The prophets Nahum, the prophets Jonah, and the prophets Daniel. They have dynamited, blown up, and destroyed every prophet's grave site anywhere that they could come across them in their territories, whether in Iraq or this is where Daniel's body was buried. Completely destroyed it and went to the trouble of smashing, blowing up, and filming and destroying everything they could find. And much better now. Democracy coming soon to a village near you. Well, we've been documenting and speaking about slavery, terrorism, and Islam to help people to understand historical roots and the contemporary threat, to understand Islam and to know how to evangelize Muslims for years. It's either Reformation or Islamization. I've been preaching that in Europe for more than 1.5 decades. And the need to pray for and evangelize in the Muslim Middle East, where the church has done the least amount of work, where we've done the least amount of evangelism and Bible teaching, the 1040 window. 10th degree to the 40th degrees latitude, northern hemisphere, from North Africa across the Middle East to South Central Asia. In that area, you've got over 4 billion non-Christians. The most unreached people in the world, the least amount of missionaries, the least amount of freedom, the highest suffering index, the most amount of oppression, and most of the world's terrorism and military threat and persecution comes in the 1040 window. Which, by the way, was the birthplace of the Christian church. Today, the most anti-Christian countries on the planet. Well, one of our main mission fields, Sudan, we've been under fire there. I have conducted over 1,200 services and lectures in South Sudan and Nuba Mountains over the years on my 27 missions there. And I've never ministered in a school, church, or hospital that hadn't been bombed at least once. Some had been bombed 8 times, 10 times. One church had been bombed 18 times in just a 12-month period. First time I was running a Muslim evangelism workshop in South Sudan, in Kotobe. They destroyed the church when we arrived in here. The pastors I had walked many kilometers with a Christian flag in the center of what once was a beautiful church, and they still wanted me to teach them how to win their enemies to Christ. We've had to have our conferences in the forest because the church buildings have been destroyed. La Ro, the slave traders' tree, where the Arabs used to tether up the Moro people and take them off to Khartoum as slaves. And just beyond is the first church in southern Sudan, the Fraser Cathedral, destroyed 3 times, rebuilt each time, over 140 bomb craters and vast amounts of shrapnel around the church. As we brought the first complete Bible in the Moro language into this church in Jumba, we were bombed on a Sunday morning during an evangelism explosion training program. This is just one of the times we've been under fire. I've preached in churches in Sudan and come under rocket, artillery, and aerial bombardment. And this is another time, another place, but if this bomb had exploded, it would have taken the church and the compound we were meeting off the map. So we know what it's like to be under fire, to have churches destroyed in Nigeria, in Egypt, in Sudan, to have churches attacked in Kenya. And this is the Nuba Mountains, where our mission team is heading right now, where for years, the school children have been hiding in the mountains and the caves from the bombing and the scorched earth. Praise God, there's a ceasefire right now, always shaky and volatile, but so our team's going in to minister with the school children during this window of opportunity. Now, some other news of the last week and a half is that Omar al-Bashir, the dictator of Sudan, for the last 30 years has been deposed in a coup, they say. There's been a lot of protests. He's wanted for war crimes, genocide, not only in Nub Mountains in South Sudan, but in Darfur and in Blue Nile. So his government's wanted for all kinds of war crimes. And he's a genocidal maniac who's got warrants of arrest issued by the International Court of Criminal Court and International Court of Justice in Hague. And he's come to this, al-Bashir has come to South Africa for medical care. And Interpol and all of that insisted that South Africa honored their signing of the genocide treaty and hand over this mass murdering war criminal wanted for genocide over to The Hague. And South Africa refused to. And our Supreme Court ordered President Zuma, hand him over. You must have him hand over. And his government didn't. And we are part of Interpol. We are signatory to the International Anti-Genocide Treaty. And yet South Africa allows genocidal maniacs like Mengistu, who's living in Zimbabwe, and, of course, Omar al-Bashir, to come here for medical care and to go straight back without being bothered by arrests. But anyway, he's now been overthrown, apparently, and it's confusing. He hasn't been handed over to The Hague. We don't know, is this a real coup? Is this just to pretend that he's been removed from power, but he's still being protected? He hasn't been arrested, as far as we can say. The military has taken over, said he's in a safe place, which means nothing. I mean, what does that mean? Now, if he is handed over to the International Court of Justice, I'll believe it's a real, genuine coup. But until then, I think it's like Zimbabwe's Mnangagwa sham a year and a half ago, where they pretended they'd had a coup to remove Mugabe, but he hasn't been charged. He's not in jail. He's not doing restitution. He's not returned the $15 billion in illicit diamonds and so on that he's stolen from the country. So I can't believe what happened in Zimbabwe is real, genuine overthrow, and similarly with Sudan, we're not convinced yet. Churches have been desecrated in other ways. The National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. opened up for Muslims to have a prayer service in the international, cathedral in Washington, D.C. And one brave Christian woman came in and rebuked them and said, Allah is not Yahweh, and Jesus Christ was crucified for our sins, and he rose from the dead, and this cathedral is built in the honor of our Lord Jesus Christ. And of course she is thrown out, but just there's different ways church is undermined. I could give you a story about when Bishop Desmond Tutu was Archbishop of St. George's Cathedral. He brought in a Buddhist monk to sit there, bald woman, banging on a drum, calling up the spirits at St. George's Cathedral. He did worse than that. There was some apostate who wrote the book The Myth of God Incarnate, and this Archbishop Desmond Tutu invited this creep to come into St. George's Cathedral and in a service tell people, and I was there, that just like the church survived understanding that the world wasn't the center of the universe, and just like we managed to survive that transubstantiation isn't true and that Mary wasn't a virgin, we can survive the fact that Jesus isn't the Son of God. And I'm bad enough that he said this idiocy, but what was worse is the applause after his speech. And then up stands arch-heretic Desmond Tutu. Oh, thank you, my brother, for these wonderful insights from the Word of God and for bringing this message from God to us. And blasphemy upon idiocy, upon apostasy, and more applause. You're thinking, are these people brain dead? Deaf, dumb, and blind. But there's hostility to Christianity growing in Europe. And I think, just look at this magnificent little miniature of Europe, St. Michael's, which is one of these Viking churches built, Viking towns and castles built in Normandy under the time of Rollo, who is the grandfather of William the Conqueror, who later turned England to Viking country too. Well, the EU, the European Union, is the Antichrist-owned kingdom. And they are trying to rebuild Babel right now. In fact, look at how they built the EU Parliament in Strasbourg, which I've been to. It's built just to model on Bruegel's Belgian depiction of the Tower of Babel, right down to the scaffolding on the outside, the incomplete structure. They are, in fact, their motto is Europe, many tongues, one voice. They're deliberately reversing Babel. They're like fist in God's face. They've even got a statue of a woman riding a beast outside. They're that blatant. Well, of course, people in Europe are a problem. So convince the people of Europe to have small families, to have no families, to adopt a dog, to have abortions, to get sterilized, to be homosexuals or lesbians, and all the rest of it. At the same time, bring in millions of Muslims. What is this? It's an Islamic invasion. Yep. This is how it goes in Paris. And what's going on in England? Well, they haven't lost all their spirituality. They've rediscovered Wicca and paganism and worshipping the sun and the moon and the stars and animals. And of course, Harry Potter's got to be the most expensive promotion of witchcraft ever. And this is now not just the most popular films in Britain, but the Harry Potter series are even used as textbooks in schools. Kids are told in British schools to make shape-shifting design curses to put on enemy, to decide magic potion things, to write all kinds of, you know, what animal would you like to be shape-shifted into, and all sorts of bizarre stuff. Harry Potter. Avatar, the most expensive film ever made in history, which is total Hinduism. And Avatar is where a god or demon takes control of a human. And in fact, these avatars are, it's total Hinduism. The term avatar comes straight from Hinduism. And the whole film is consistent with the Hindu concept of avatars and so on. And of course, atheism and humanism. And in Britain, they've got, as a professor of Oxford University, Richard Dawkins. What a complete and utter evil creep. And this man sponsors adverts and buses say there's no God. Probably no God. Doesn't even have the courage to say there is no God. And, yep, you don't just have dumb people out there. You have evil people out there. And there's a destruction of the culture. You see, when you look at a culture, the ancient Christian cultures lifted up the beautiful, the excellent, as seen in the cathedrals and in the music, like Handel's Messiah, and the arts. But what does our society focus on? Mindless, meaningless, you came from nothing, you're going nowhere, life is meaningless, desecrate your body, tattoo, body pierce, everything, and of course, be a pervert, sure, I mean, that's always going to help, let's bring down the population. And blatant, blasphemous, antichrist atheism, this is the spirit of Europe today. If Jesus returns, kill him again. UndoJesus.org. Picture of put Christianity in the trash can. That's on his t-shirt. Imagine the audacity of anyone having the absolute arrogance to do something like that. And meanwhile, people are jailed for preaching the Bible. We've even had a British military officer retired, Adrian Clark, here ministering at our fellowship, who was locked up in Bristol, which is George Whitfield's open-air preaching capital. That's where he started open-air preaching, in Bristol. And locked up for street preaching. Upset someone. Dr. David Drew was fired for emailing a prayer to hospital colleagues. This 64-year-old doctor, who for 40 years had been a senior medical specialist and a director for many years at the hospital, was dismissed for emailing a prayer, which he thought might encourage and inspire his colleagues. Here's the offensive prayer, in full. Teach us, good Lord, to serve you as you deserve. To give and not to count the cost, to fight and not to heed the wounds, to toil and not to seek for rest, to labor not to ask for any reward, save that of knowing that we do your will. For this, an exemplary doctor of 40 years service gets dismissed from the hospital. The head of the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation, Mark Thompson, admitted that Christianity is treated with far less sensitivity than other religions, because it's pretty broad-shouldered. Now, how's this for an understatement? He said that as other faiths have a very close identity with ethnic minorities, and as they had to consider the possibilities of violent threats instead of polite complaints, which is more common for Christians, the BBC tended to apply satire towards Christianity rather than, for example, Islam. Without question, I complain the strongest possible terms is different from, I complain the strongest possible terms that I'm loading my AK-47 as I write. quote-unquote from the CEO of the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation. What a bunch of spineless cowards. Although British Airways allows members of other religious groups special status for religious garments, you can wear the Muslim hijab, the burqa, you can wear the Sheikh turban or the Kara bracelet, you can have the Hindu dot on your forehead, but Christian employees have been forbidden to wear a cross, which breaches BA's uniform code. I mean, that cross is so much more intrusive than a burqa or a turban. Yep, for this little cross, this woman got fired. Bullying, brutish. The BBC has been also criticised for its senseless hypocrisy and no longer referring to dates as BC, before Christ, and AD, Anno Domini, but to what they call religiously neutral terms of BCE, before the Common Era, and CE, Common Era. I encourage you, with all the strength and fibre in your being, to resist this anti-Christian. They're trying to attack every single thing Christian. They want to take away Sundays, they want to take away BC, AD, every single thing that is Christian. Do you think of the etymology of the word goodbye? God be with you. That's the etymology of the word. Goodbye, God be with you. It's a prayer. Holiday comes from holy day. They want to destroy every single Christian root from the trivial to the significant important. And Oxford University was founded by professors like Professor John Wycliffe, the Morning Star of the Reformation. There was a time when it was the greatest university on earth. And now they've got idiots like Richard Dawkins there. British Member of Parliament David Simpson responded to the frequent claims of secular campaigners that Christianity has been the cause of the worst historical crimes while pointing out, in fact, ideologically atheist regimes have committed the worst atrocities throughout the 20th century. He also pointed out Christians are facing increasing persecution at the hands of aggressive secularism. In the United Kingdom, the policy seems to be that people can do whatever they like against Christianity. They can criticize it or blaspheme the name of Jesus Christ as long as they do not insult Islam. It's sad because this country is based on civil and religious liberty for all. He catalogued numerous cases of British Christians who publicly object to homosexuality or sex education and abortion, or who simply just try to share their faith with us, who face prosecution, arrest, imprisonment. What you're seeing is a deliberate, blatant, anti-Christian, conscious attempt to rebuild Babel and replace these horrible, intolerant Christians with peaceful, tolerant Muslims. Can't you just feel the tolerance? Just take, for example, this young girl who at 17 years old, this teenager, was suffocated to death having plastic bags forced into her mouth in front of her siblings. Her brothers and sisters had to watch while her parents killed their sister, stuffed her into a suitcase, took her out and dumped her in the river, and they were threatened, don't you dare talk about it or we will kill you too. Nice to know you got parents like that. Well, it took years to solve this problem. This happened, I think, in 2011. And in 2003, they finally solved the mystery and arrested the father and mother. And so it was Shafila Ahmed, 17-year-old, who was murdered by her parents because she was too westernized. The final straw was she wore a t-shirt, short-sleeve t-shirt, which obviously justifies her being killed. And these are a whole lot of other people who've been murdered. Take Mala Yousafzai, who said, blessed are those who live in non-Islamic countries. Even in the 21st centuries, Muslim countries like Pakistan, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Somalia, and Afghanistan have a ban on women getting any education. Islam treats women as slaves. Islam gives us nothing but terrorism, jihad, madrasas, riots, and bomb blasts. If we want a future for us, we have to renounce Islam. Peace and Islam cannot coexist. For she was locked up for that. These are just some other honor murders. These are girls in Britain who were murdered by their parents under honor murders. And do you know the BBC managed to bring out a program, a half an hour documentary on honor murders, the spate and epidemic of honor murders in Britain, without once mentioning Islam, Muslims, the Quran, Muhammad, anything to do with the cause. It's like, you know, there's these British parents who are just out there killing their children. You know, this isn't exactly Murphy and MacDonald and Paddy doing it. This is Rashid, Abdullah, and Muhammad. It's a totally Muslim distinctive. The religion of peace should not kill in the name of religion. And then you take the Arab Spring, which was being presented to us like a good thing. And I was one of the few people who was publishing at the time saying, in 2011, there's no way this is a good thing. This is bad. This is not an Arab Spring. This is a Christian winter. Just take one example of Sharia law. The 16-year-old girl, Atfa Rajabi Shahali, age 16, sentenced to death for being raped. She was the victim of rape, so she got executed. She got hung. Why? Because a woman is always to blame for rape. Women have the power of enticement, says Sharia law. Therefore, the woman is 90% to blame. If she's raped, it's her fault. The man gets maybe a slap on the wrist. Naughty. Try not to do that again. He doesn't even get a suspended sentence. He doesn't even pay a fine. She gets hung. Or shot in the head in Afghanistan. Or beheaded in Saudi Arabia. Or buried up to her waist and stoned if she's in Pakistan. But this is the insanity of Sharia law. Woman tied to a post and stoned to death by ISIS. This is Sharia law. Women are possessions bought and sold under Islam. And they're trying to bring this into Britain and France. This is Shariaistan. Sharia law has no place in a civilized society. These are just some of the rapists in England, for example. You know, notice something in common here, Islamic, yep. It's Jihad UK. Even the British MI5 say there's over 1,500 British Muslims who have left to join ISIS and so on. And in fact, that's so low. I've seen the statistics more like they've got 30,000 Muslim terrorists in Britain itself. So, now we come to Paris. Paris. Ratatouille, all that sort of thing. Where even a rat can cook better than the best French chef, according to Disney World. And they have the Paris riots, and they even spoke about the French youth rioting. Well, you know, it wasn't Pierre rioting, it was Abdullah and Rashid. And in the Paris riots, they destroyed thousands of vehicles, hundreds of buildings, vast amounts of destruction. What for? Because some journalist in Denmark put a cartoon of Muhammad. Well, what's it got to do with Paris? Nothing, but who cares? Any excuse for burning things? Now, notice, the person who took this picture of a Danish flag, which has got, of course, a cross in it, white cross and red, they did it in such a way that they'd have the cross on top of the steeple in the background, slightly out of focus. That's a deliberate statement. How clear can they be? Burning the Swedish flag. In fact, they burn every country's flag. I mean, there's no way of showing that you appreciate foreign aid and freebies more than burning the flag of your host country. So, what do we say now about Notre Dame? Do you know, the fire was still burning. And they were still pouring millions of gallons of water into the place. And the French President Macron's government issued a statement saying they've ruled out terrorism or arson. It was obviously an accident. This is absolutely remarkable. I mean, I worked in a fire brigade. Let me tell you, that's got to be the fastest forensics ever done. The fire wasn't out. The water was still pouring. And they'd already determined it definitely wasn't arson or terrorism. How could they know that? This is just staggering to show that what are they hiding? Now, I looked at a major report this afternoon from Canadian intelligence and American intelligence sources, which have said this is definitely terrorism. In fact, I've seen that this is definitely a false flag operation, which the French intelligence community was involved in doing. It's a self-inflicted, just like the New Zealand false flag attack on the mosque. Anyway, that's something worth looking into, but that's just something else. So remember, what people are seeing here is this is the embodiment of France. Now, you look there, and you and I, we would see a symbol of Western Christian civilization, a symbol of European civilization, a sacred symbol, a cathedral built in the shape of a cross. But the Frenchmen don't see that. What they see is the major icon of France. This, in fact, they've got in front of it Ground Zero, or the center of France, where every single road is centered on, in front of the cathedral. I've stood there at at this cathedral and stood on that actual circle, ground zero there. But this attack on this church didn't come in a vacuum. Do you know, just a month before, 17 of March 2019, Paris's second largest church, St. Sulpice, burst into flames with fire damaging the doors, stained glass windows, burning exterior, and a police and fire brigade confirmed it was definitely arson. So arson a month before with the second largest church in Paris. This is the largest church in Paris. So this is a month later. Now, just in the last month, there have been 11 churches attacked and desecrated in France. Probably all arson too. According to French official police records, 875 churches in France, 875, have been attacked, vandalized, or burned in the last 12 months. But we know for sure this was an accident. This is not arson. This is not, this couldn't possibly be terrorism. We haven't done any forensics, but we know. And the police records give all kinds of details of, like, St. Alain Cathedral in Lavare set on fire, statues and crosses smashed, people arrested in some cases, all kinds. St. Nicholas Church in Hulluz, and then the Church of Notre Dame in Dijon, vandalized and desecrated. So this, to give you an idea, is the Notre Dame Cathedral. So the spire, which also had this lead and wooden roof, which totally collapsed. And interestingly enough, they were having renovations there, so there's scaffolding on. So, of course, the immediate suggestion is, well, it must have been because of renovations. Well, renovations have been done over the last 800 years without a fire. So it survived the Second World War unscathed. The last time it was destroyed or damaged or vandalized was during the French Revolution 230 years ago. But here you've got the famous west rose window, and you've got the north and south towers. So this just gives you a bit of a feel for what is going on there. And this is this famous spire. You can see the scaffolding. So the fact there were renovations might have made it easier to slip in arson devices, fire starters. But to suggest that the renovation caused the fire, well, why would you ever have any place renovated if a renovation involves fire? Surely they would have all kinds of things to prevent a fire. You'd have professionals dealing with it. But Notre Dame is more than a monumental architectural achievement. Notre Dame has for centuries been the icon of French identity. It is a monolithic achievement of Western civilization. It testifies to the central role of Christianity in development of Europe. So the destruction of Notre Dame is a blow on France. It's a blow on Christianity. It's a blow on Europe. It's the greatest Gothic architectural building in the world. It's the most popular tourist attraction in France. It's the most visited location in all of France, 13 million a year. I heard a report yesterday that said 20 million people visit Notre Dame a year. Well, I've stuck to the lowest figure, which is 13 million. And the cathedrals that have dominated the skylines of Europe for centuries have pointed to the central role of Christianity in providing a worldview that made Christian civilization possible. And it's the cathedrals that are symbols of the preeminence of Christianity in culture, art, music, sciences, architecture. Look at the different posts, and I'm told there are thousands of posts of people with Muslim names with pictures of the burning cathedral and happy and laughing face emojis. And, for example, Notre Dame on fire is the most aesthetically pleasing visually I've ever seen. While the world is crying for the burning of Notre Dame, I can't stop thinking about Haiti, America, and Africa, and how the 1,000 years of art and history have been burned and destroyed at the hands of white people. I hope that bitch burns to dust. Okay? 1,000 years of art and history was burned by the white people invading Haiti? It's art and history. Thatched roofs and mud huts can't last for thousands of years. About 5 years, 10 years max, and they fall to pieces because of insects. The front entrance to Notre Dame was adorned with an anti-Semitic allusion, but no, you're right, I should weep for the devastating loss. So this is the Jewish worker. He's basically, you know, there's lots of Jews saying, great, because Notre Dame was anti-Semitic. And Al Jazeera television said, Oh, this is wonderful, because Al Jazeera reported on the 16th of April, the day after the fire, Notre Dame was the church where crusaders were blessed before they left for the Holy Land. And so thousands of Muslims have placed happy, smiley face, laughing face emojis over this picture of burning cathedral, saying, you know, this is great. And this is what the roof looked like from inside during the fire, what it looked like the next day after they put the fire out. Tragic. And the cathedral inside. Now, you won't appreciate the devastation till I show you what it was like before. But can I just draw your attention to the altar, the high altar, which is several meters above the floor. You can see the statue of Mary dominating the high altar with a dead corpse of Jesus, her son, lying over. So Jesus is dead. Mary is alive. That dominates the cathedral. Also, it is named Notre Dame, which is Our Lady of Paris. Notre Dame, the Blessed Virgin Mary. So here you see the statue of Louis the 14th. Louis the 14th? Who's he? The Sun King. The one who abolished religious freedom in France in 1685 with the abolition, revocation of the Edict of Nantes, and compelled all Huguenots to convert to Catholicism, which led to hundreds of thousands fleeing the country and hundreds even coming as far as the Cape. Hence we have the French Huguenots, friendship, and so on. And here's him. Here's Louis XIV, the worst king France ever had, the Sun King, who murdered so many Christians and destroyed so many churches. He's offering his crown to Mary. And you've got another French king here bowing down in Saar too. So you see, there's quite a bit of idolatry, of course. I mean, this is a French Catholic cathedral. But interesting, what did they see when they went in on Wednesday morning after the fire was out? Everything else is covered in dust and ashes, but the sun just lit up the cross itself, which is a message right there. This is what it looked like before, Notre Dame. And one of the greatest, certainly the greatest in France, but one of the greatest churches in all of Europe. And the amount of work that went into it, it's just phenomenal. Now, let me make it clear. I'm a Protestant. I'm an evangelical. I do not believe in the sacramental design of the cathedral, because they've designed the whole cathedral to symbolize the Mass and to sacrifice Christ. You see, Christ is dead in that monument over the altar. He is dead, and Mary's alive, and the whole symbolism there is Mary is the co-redemptrix. She is, you don't go to Jesus direct, you go through Mary. Forget this, I'm the way, the truth, and life. No one comes to the Father through me. There's one man, one God, and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus. Don't worry about those verses. You know, Mary is the way. You pray to Mary, she takes it to Son, she'll get you the answers to your prayers. Now, of course, Notre Dame, while it's owned by the French government, you realize that this does not belong to the Catholic Church. It belongs to the French government. The Catholic Church gets to use it. The French government owns the property. The Catholic Church can use it, but the French government pays for two-thirds of its upkeep. Now, the church must provide the other third. And so, right now, there's a big argument that, well, as the church is owned by the state's going to redesign it. And so Macron wants to redesign it as an interfaith to symbolize the fact that France is a secular country and that we have many faiths. And so he wants to put an interfaith, secular type of new design to it. So the burning of this church could be a total plan for restructuring and to take out a lot of the expressly Christian images. Now, of course, Notre Dame's got some very strong Christian imagery, but it's got a lot of idolatry in it too, which we as Protestants are not happy with. So how should we feel? I've read some Protestants saying, I don't weep for that. You know, I laugh for it because this is just a temple of idolatry. It's a Romish temple. It deserves to be destroyed. And so I've read some Christian Reformed evangelical friends of mine saying that this is nothing. Who cares? In fact, I've even seen some people saying, you know, 1,000 churches get attacked in Nigeria and no one cares. Why should I care about one church in France? Well, I've been pointing out for many, many years, why is it that when Charlie Hebdo got attacked. That what Charlie Hebdo was journalist, blasphemous, antichrist, secular humanist, evil people who were always attacking Christianity and Christ. But they did one edition that had some cartoons on Muhammad. They get attacked and murdered. Obviously, that's bad. And one doesn't even want horrible blasphemers to get murdered. You want to give them a chance to repent and hear the gospel. But still, the heads of 28 governments marched in Paris, including Benjamin Netanyahu and Angela Merkel and Francois Hollande. They're all there and all this nonsense. And but that same week, hundreds of Christians were massacred by Boko Haram in Nigeria, and not a word. And so I point out, this is blatant hypocrisy, and why this selective outrage and selective compassion and this heartless lack of caring for Christians suffering in Africa. So I've been saying that for years. But it's not the same thing to say the destruction of an 800-year-old cathedral that contains vast amounts of oil on canvas, irreplaceable treasures, and all kinds of a lot of history, which epitomizes the entire nation. That is not to be compared with a prefab or brick building or a mud and thatched hut, for that matter, that's used for worship, in terms of the loss to civilization history as a whole. And even though this is a Roman Catholic cathedral, which is filled with idolatry and all kinds of fake, seriously fake relics, I should mention some of the scenes that they gave you about this in the church. By the way, they've got all kinds of different bells, and that's another story. But okay, we spoke about the organ, spoke about some of the decoration. Do you get an idea of what's been lost? This is not the way I believe in decorating churches. You're on our mission. We believe in bookshelves and literature stands. We are not into this sort of thing. But I've visited many cathedrals all over the world, and it tells you a lot about art, architecture, history, culture. It's more than a monument. It's a church. And I believe the reformers themselves would have wept for the loss of this cathedral. Because even though it's got idols there, the reformers never advocated the destruction of cathedrals or churches. They wanted them reformed. And so what did the Protestant reformers do when they took over a cathedral like Westminster Abbey, for example, or Cologne Cathedral, or any, or in Augsburg? What did they do? They took away the idols. They took away the screen that separated the clergy from the laity. They took away the barrier between the clergy and the laity. They didn't just have the people fed the wafer symbolizing the body of Christ, but also the fruit of the vine, the grape juice symbolizing the blood of Christ, which before was reserved only for the clergy. The laity only got the wafer. The clergy could get the fruit of the vine. They also brought pews into the church. Pews didn't exist before the Reformation. Pews were brought in because up till then, Catholics had people come and stand in church, men on one side, women on the other. And the Protestants changed that. They pews, bring seats and so on, and they started to bring the Word of God central. You didn't just come to church to open your mouth and receive a wafer. You now came to church, you didn't just bring your body to church, you brought your mind too, because preaching and teaching of the Word of God was central. And instead of you listening to the liturgy in Latin and hearing the choir in Latin, you would now hear the Word of God in your own language, and you would sing the hymns of the faith in your own language. How radical is that? And so the Protestants changed and adapted the architecture. They dismantled the altar, and they put a table, the Lord's table. They brought a pulpit more central. They made the preaching and teaching of the Word, in many cases on the Lord's table, they'd have an open Bible, symbolizing open access. The open Bible on a Lord's table was where the screen used to be that blocked off the view of people, the laity, from even seeing what was happening at the high altar. So they changed the architecture of the churches. They reformed the churches. They did not burn, demolish, or destroy them. And so I believe the reformers who wanted to reform the church would not rejoice in the destruction of any of the buildings. And remember, this building was built before the Catholic Counter-Reformation, before the real total corruption of Catholicism, which set in by the 14th century in mass. But, of course, this represents Christendom. This represents Christianity. But if you look here, you will get, okay, this is the entrance to the cathedral. What do you see? Jesus is sitting on a throne. But there is Mary praying next to him, there's an angel, and we think that's John the Baptist. Sorry, that's the Mother Mary, and on this side it would be John the Apostle. And notice, Jesus is judging. There's books opened by the angel. He's got a sword there. But below you see an angel with scales. You see the scales? And who's next to him? The devil. And some people are going off to heaven singing, and others are being taken in chains off to hell. On the basis of the scales, Jesus judging, with the advice of his mother, of course. And you can see some people suffering below. And you see angels around. Now, remember, most of the people when the cathedral was built were illiterate. Most of the people couldn't read and write. Vast majority. So what they saw in the stones and what they saw in the stained glass windows was about the only gospel they had. Because they didn't understand what was being said. What was being said in the church was in Latin. What was being sung in the church was in Latin. And if you didn't speak Latin, which 90% of people couldn't speak, then you didn't really know what was being sung or said. Just like the average person going to a mosque today, it's all in Arabic. And if he doesn't know Arabic, he doesn't know what's going on. But so this here is, this is not good. We would have reworked this. This also has Jesus presenting his crown to Mary. How heretical is that? What about this here? Okay, here you can see the high altar. And notice that Mary dominates. She's the one actually doing the real intercession. And it's her sufferings, because she's seeing her son suffer, that's really winning our salvation. And that was made clear by John Paul II, that it was the Jesus' sufferings alone did not win our salvation. It's Mary's sufferings that won our salvation. He wanted her declared co-redemptrix, which many Catholics believe anyway. But I think there was a lot of resistance. See here, Louis the 14th offering his crown to Mary. And so, interesting symbolism here. But all of this was covered, and all you could see was the cross after the fire. Interesting. This is the most valuable treasure of Notre Dame, according to the caretakers. It's the crown of thorns. And the crown of thorns they've preserved there, and this is... Look, there's another dozen real crown of thorns in different Catholic cathedrals and churches around the world, but this is the real one. This is the others are also the real ones, but this is the really real one. And they've not only got this for you to come and kiss every now and then, and that'll get you who knows how many thousand years of purgatory, but they've got an actual nail that pierced the body of Christ. Now, there were only three nails that pierced one of the feet or the hands of Christ, but there are at least nine in other churches and cathedrals in France, but and not counting how many are in Spain and Italy, but still, they've got one of the real ones. And when you think of the destruction of this church in the days of the French Revolution and its desecration, and this is just a tribute to the French Revolution beheading all these biblical kings. I mean, how meaningless, petty, stupid, and thoughtless. What a waste of time and energy. But that just shows the French Revolutionary mentality. And now you've got the fire brigade looking over some of the undamaged rose windows, which are seriously priceless. Do you know the people who are the, what do you call it, the renovators, the maintainers of it, say, we wouldn't know how to remake much of the masonry and stained glass windows. We've lost a lot of those skills. You know, you'd think we're more advanced than previous generations. We cannot make silk as fine as some in existence today. Japanese can't. They can't make steel as fine as some old samurais of the Japanese samurais. And they've tried. And people still can't make honey. Only bees can make honey. It doesn't matter how much ingenuity has gone into it. So there's so many things that when you go into a cathedral, one thing it's meant to do is humble you and make you realize how great God is and how actually insignificant we are in comparison. So it's to declare the majesty and transcendence of God. Now, this is Saint Sulpice, the second largest church in Paris, which was the subject of an arson attack just a month before. But we know that Notre Dame wasn't arson, even though the attack on Notre Dame is during the Holy Week, straight off the Palm Sunday. heading into Holy Week, heading up to Good Friday, the most important significant date in the Christian calendar. If it's not terrorism, what a strange coincidence it's at such a strategic time. These are maps of where other churches have been desecrated or suffered arson attacks in France in the last year. But we know that the one in Paris, the biggest, the oldest, the most valuable, definitely an accident. Okay, we haven't had time to do any forensics yet. The fire brigade hasn't gone yet. They still were putting out the fire, but the government knew it wasn't terrorism, wasn't arson. Doesn't this tell you they've got a lot to hide? Christian civilization has actually been hijacked and damaged. And I think this is one of the most important things to get out of this, is that what we're seeing in Notre Dame is a symbol of, yes, Notre Dame, but hijacked with a false gospel. Because the true treasure of the church is not stupid fake relics. Even if you had the actual crown of thorns and the actual nail and you had the actual chalice from the Last Supper, even if someone had kept some of the actual blood of Jesus shed on the cross in a vase, and I had it here tonight, it couldn't possibly add anything to any of our salvation. Even if you had the actual wood of the cross, they claim they've got the real cross in this cathedral too. There's no end of indulgences and relics and fake things there. But even if they were the real thing, so what? When we say that you're saved by the blood of Christ, that's evangelical shorthand for the atonement of Christ. If you had the actual blood of Christ, you couldn't get salvation from it. If your heart was unregenerate and you've got a vial with the actual blood of Christ, that wouldn't save you. If you had the actual cross, do you know when my one son was born with kidney failure, we had a Catholic phone us up, a pro-life advocate said, I have a piece of the true cross of Christ which I will lend you to lay on your son. I said, I'm very grateful. I appreciate what that means for me, but please understand, we are Protestants. You don't want it? No, thank you. But it's the real cross, and you know, got the certificate dating back to the sign by this bishop, and really appreciate, but we're Protestants. And he's just stunned while we were turned off. He's got a piece of the real cross. And, well, even if he had the whole cross, so what? If we don't get saved by the physical items. The real treasure of the church is the gospel of Christ, Martin Luther said in 95 Theses. So when we look at Notre Dame, first of all, we've got to recognize Christian civilization has been hijacked and it's been severely damaged. Notre Dame should remind us of a great Christian heritage which has been hijacked and undermined, even openly attacked by secularists and by Islamists. Now, where this fire was started by secularists, communists, anti-Christian atheists, or by Islamic jihadists, I don't know. But I've got no doubt whatsoever it was maliciously started. But what it is symbolic of is there are those who hate Christianity and are seeking to hijack civilization. And this is a physical reminder of a spiritual reality, an intellectual reality. But then you get Amos 3 verse 6. If there is calamity in a city, will not the Lord have done it? Now, this doesn't change the guilt of individuals who are involved, but it means that God who allows things to take place, what man means for evil, God can use for good, and God can work all things together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. But nevertheless, even when a calamity hits, whether it's natural disaster or man-made disaster, when Jesus was pointed to a man-made disaster and a natural disaster, the tower that fell killed a whole lot of people in Siloam, the people murdered in the temple by Pilate, and he said, do you think there were worse sinners than you? But I tell you no, unless you repent, you'll all likewise perish. And so Jesus used a natural and a man-made disaster to call people to repentance. I think we need to do that too, because while I can take absolutely no joy and only grief at the loss of such a monumentally important architectural masterpiece and such a wonderful example of Christian civilization's achievements in architecture, yet God may have allowed this as a judgment on wicked idolatry. To the average Frenchman, Notre Dame was a symbol of France, not of the church. It was a national treasure which evoked patriotism rather than theism. And to the, even when you hear President Macron's talking about, he's talking about this national treasure and all. He's talking about the, he's not talking in any sense about a church or a cathedral or anything of spiritual value. And so, while this is terrible, and it's a terrible loss, but then God stood by and allowed, in fact, decreed the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem twice. Because he hates idolatry. And so, I've just got to put out there that even though this is a terrible act, probably terrorism, possibly a false flag, but you could also see the hand of God in judgment upon an empty religion. And of course, you've got your dear Muslims rejoicing, and freedom of expression, go to hell. And he's using freedom of expression to say that. And of course, here you've got proud to be a British Muslim, Islam is peace.org, but actions speak a bit louder than your words. And so one of the British schools teaching the kids, get them chained up in yokes and walk them along, and have them fall on their knees and beg for mercy. People who never enslaved anyone begging mercy from people who never were slaves. What meaning is this? People who didn't do the crime? Apologizing to people who weren't a victim? Like, so what? No borders, no nations, stop deportations. No borders, no white nations, stop deportations. Multiculturalism, the philosophy of self-destruction producing catastrophic events of biblical proportions for generations. And this is not an unrealistic scenario. Complete and utter destruction of Western civilization. If they continue to be anti-Christian, anti-God, in the way that they're continuing, they are gutting their countries. Western Europe will destroy itself if it keeps on this path. There are some people waking up in Germany and Switzerland, making stands against Islam, stop the Islamization of Europe. Monuments matter. Now, Cecil John Rhodes is not in my top 100 or top 1,000 favorite people, but he was the founder of University of Cape Town. And this attack on a monument started a whole stream of things. You can see there is such a hostility for monuments. But even if it's a monument of someone bad that I don't like, I wouldn't want it brought down because it's history. You can even teach from bad history. And destruction of monuments like this monument to the horses that died in the Anglo-Boer War, this kind of desecration by the EFF and of different people in the past. You just look at seagull, dog, horse, man. Man is a clever animal who behaves like an imbecile, said Albert Schweitzer, missionary to Africa. And what can you say about people who complain about service delivery and burn and destroy things? How on earth is that going to improve life or the economy or safety or transport for anyone? And attacking people because they, in this case, xenophobia, attacking people because they're from another country like Nigeria or the Congo or Ghana in this case. This is, you know, South African flags with pangas. This has actually happened. Smashing, pangering, hacking people. And, of course, kill the white racists, farm murders must continue, murder the pink pig, settler go home, slaughter whiteness, Africa for the Africans, kill the Boer, use the very naughty word. Yeah, so you put a guy in stocks and beat him up or throw him in jail while they can swinging cats to kill him. And unfortunately, this is all true. These have happened. And then you get Eskom, which has been looted. 139 billion theft, they're probing. They've kicked out all kinds of engineers. Now, in the past, to be the CEO of Eskom, you had to be a graduate engineer. Since the year 2000, not a single CEO of Eskom has been an engineer. You know, to have people who are not engineers running a major engineering operation is just not clever. It's just like, since when did we actually have an economist being Minister of Finance? We used to have people who'd been successful businessmen and as Minister of Finance. Now you have people who've organized strikes, stayaways, boycotts, riots, and so on. And they now do. It's bizarre. When this book, Gangster State, came out, it was trashed and attacked in the shops in Johannesburg. But we are a gangster state. And yes, this is the sort of thing you can see. How can a poor person run a business? How do you expect shops to manage? Are you wondering why prices are going up? Well, how can they pay for the looting and destruction of shops like this? The burning of cars, disruption of commerce, travel. Somebody's got to pay to put these things up. How do you expect the fire brigade or the ambulance to get to your home if you've destroyed the roads and blocked everything? They call these ANC milestones. Now, how is an ambulance or a fire brigade truck meant to get to you if you need them? They can't even spell. They can't even spell. They can't even proofread a... And you know what these billboards cost? And they put... this is the cost of millions that they printed these billboards. And I don't know if it's tougher or together, but whatever it's meant to be, you're meant to vote ANC. They can't even spell or proofread a billboard, which has got, what, 6 or 7 words on this, and they can't even spell it. This is a good reason why you shouldn't vote for them. And blowing a shofar in Parliament isn't going to solve the problem. Here you've got traffic police putting up EFF posters, which is illegal, actually. When a president lives like this, and the ministers live like that, and the deputy ministers and premiers live like that, but the voters live like that, here the people are writing why? Because of failure of service delivery, which is whose fault? The government. And now they're still going to vote for them a sixth time. And so obviously that's why the voters' guide is important. We're heading to elections. We're only a few weeks away from it. It's so important to reclaim our Christian heritage, to demonstrate to the world that the Bible has the best answers to all of society's most pressing problems. Symbolized by the church and its steeple, which dominates any decent community. But now churches in South Africa are being attacked. This isn't Pretoria. A Dutch Reformed church that had become a gereformeerde kerk, which was trashed, vandalized by rioters, I think near Boysens in Pretoria. Just the contempt for the cross and for churches. And this is not far up the N7. This is in the Western Cape, about 160-odd k's from Cape Town, somewhere near Ceres. And this is, yeah, West Coast District Municipality. We are seeing attacks on churches. We're seeing attacks on farmers. We need to return to the Bible to rebuild civilization. We need to do more than just rebuild walls of buildings. We need to lay solid foundations to rebuild Christian civilization on the Bible, applying the Lordship of Christ to all areas of life. Isaiah 58 verse 12 says, "Those from among you shall build the old waste places. You shall raise up the foundation of many generations, and you shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in." So, any comments, any questions? As here we are at the southernmost tip of Africa. This is not a perspective we often see, but we're just behind that devil's peak over. Any questions or comments?
It's quite ironic how the average man on the street going to vote doesn't consider who they put in power or in charge of Eskom, which is control over a nuclear power station.
It's pretty serious. If that goes, we're in deep trouble. And it almost went on November 11th, 2005, because the engineers had a piece of paper, but they weren't doing maintenance. It's very serious to mismanage nuclear power stations. And of course, everyone suffers in the power failure.
I know we're talking about, this affects it, but if we look at South Africa and how the looting and the burning and the destruction in our South Africa only, we aren't reaching them easily to let them understand that that's not the way.
Correct. Well, we're certainly trying. I mean, for example, I spoke at a youth conference in KwaZulu-Natal with something like 8,000 young people just a year ago, and less than a year ago. And we had a minister's conference with 2,500 people, mostly Zulus, people from South Africa, in KwaZulu-Natal just in March of this year. Of course, we're doing on radio, we're doing massive amounts of literature distribution. But of course, yes, the bulk of people we're not reaching. We've got to do what we can, but the trouble is the government controls the mass media, and most of the people get their news from SATV,
yes,
which is run by the very criminals themselves who are looting the country. So yes, we've got to do everything we can. Literature, social media, radio stations, community radio stations, distributing literature, letterboxes, neighbours, churches. Got to do what we can. But it's disturbing that the really big mass media is in the hands of those who just don't care.
Especially amongst the youth, the multimedia and the social media is one of the best ways nowadays to create awareness and get things out.
It's staggering how many on there are pro-ANC and so on. I must say social media seems to be used more for alternative, but there are still some people fairly brain dead, thinking EFF's the answer for the future and the ANC really are trying and... Where do these people come from? But still, at least there's a chance to interact on that level. The great thing about social media, it's something that we didn't have when I was growing up. The government controlled everything. You did not, if it wasn't the government, it was Anglo-American controlled the newspapers and the Beers. They controlled all English newspapers in particular. National Party controlled the Afrikaans press and radio and TV. But what we do have on our side now is social media, desktop publishing, community radio stations. We've been able to break out the stranglehold of just the New World Order, Rothschild, Oppenheimers, Ruperts, and so on, dominating everything. So now we can reach millions. Okay, they reach the billions, but we can reach the millions through independent sources. The trouble is most people are happy with the general mainstream media deception, and that's sad. But... we can do something, and we've got to do what we can. And, of course, one of the things that's very promising in this upcoming election is that there are quite a few parties that are going against the business as usual, and that's very nice. I just don't know why anyone would waste their time on any of the parties that have been in power up till now from the ANC and DA side, because they've obviously failed. So one should be encouraging people to consider the alternatives. There are some better alternatives out there for sure. I'm not referring to the good for nothing party.
Yeah, but now with these alternatives, but there's no uniting between them.
Sadly, although we have tried, I've brought 12 different Christian political parties into this boardroom at one time and tried to knock their heads together to cooperate. And with the exception of one or two, most parties weren't willing to cooperate. They all try and do their own thing. I do hope that we would get a better cooperation. If we can get these big parties, I'm talking about the DA locally and ANC nationally, below half, then we've got hope. Because, you know, in Switzerland and in Netherlands, they don't have majority parties. They've got about 12 to 13 political parties in each parliament. Switzerland and Netherlands. And so the only way you can rule is to be an alliance. You've got to have a coalition. So if we could get to that point, then we've got some hope. Because I don't know if you remember, but Cape Town was once pretty well run. And that's just when we didn't have a majority party in the Western Cape. The DA had a minority, a big minority, but they needed the ACDP and the Freedom Front to stay in power. And so the ACDP had deputy mayor, Freedom Front at town clerk, and actually Cape Town worked well until 2004, or was it earlier, when the DA got a majority and they just kicked out the coalition and they started to become a real bunch of secular humanist, pro-perversion, pro-abortion pagans. And the arrogance, as soon when the DA was a minority party in the coalition, they were actually quite good. The moment they got a majority, just like out of control. It's wonderful when all parties can be kept into a coalition situation where nobody has a majority. And so, you know, the American situation of winner takes all is bad. Our situation where we've got proportional representation is better. But then you need the courage of people to think independently and to have the courage to stick together. Some people have this idea that, well, I know that DA's secular humanist, atheist, pagan, pro-perversion, pro-abortion, do a lot of socialism, this and then alliance with the EFF in so many other cities like Durban, Eastland. But we need to vote DA. to keep the ANC and EFF out. But they don't keep them out. They can't even keep them off the beach from slaughtering a sheep in Camps Bay or protect the people in Hermanus from land invaders. So how are they going to protect us? Why would we expect them to do better than the pathetic job they've done recently with the water disasters and everything else like this if we vote for them again? But there's a lot of people who will vote for them thinking, well, they're better than ANC. Well, yeah, just about everything's better than ANC, but we've got other alternatives. And then you get this panic, but all the lies on the lamppost, just walking on, keep the lights on. Oh, I hadn't noticed them keeping the lights on so far. All the way, and keep the ANC and EFF out of the Western Cape. What have they done to keep them out of Hermanus and Sea Point's beaches? Slaughtering sheep in violation of the rules and regulations. And there were more police there than there were BLF people on the beach with their sheep. And they still didn't act because they were ordered from top not to. So why we should trust the DA? The DA couldn't even fire Patricia DeLille after how many months and years of corruption and everything else. And by the time she left, she's taken who knows how many people with. So I think the DA is a complete and utter catastrophe. So I'll speak about the DANC. I think they're just ANC lights.
I was going to say that they're just ANC under a different banner.
In fact, their posters even look the same. Anyway, they've just got a bit more blue. But yes, no, I mean, to me, they're a bunch of crooks, the whole bunch of them. All of them corrupt as hell. Wouldn't any existing party that's part of the corruption, I wouldn't give them another vote. But sadly, the very people who are writing on the streets about bad government, bad service delivery, bad everything else, they're the ones who vote for these characters. They're the ones who need to start realizing the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. You know, to vote ANC once was stupid. To vote ANC twice was actually brainless. To vote for them five times, terminal insanity. To consider voting for them a sixth time, well, I mean, people like that shouldn't be out without adult supervision. Yeah, I mean, they're really bad. Praise God for America that's at least got term limitations of two terms, which is 8 years. Unfortunately, two terms for us would be 10 years, which is too much. But that would still be better than some of what you have. Term limitation, nice idea. In fact, I don't think you should have any professional politicians. If we could get back to biblical principles would be, there's no way you could be a professional politician getting all kinds of massive freebies. I remember when politicians were normal people at normal jobs. They had to have a real job. My history teacher at school in Bulawayo in Rhodesia was a member of parliament. I said, and you're a teacher as well. He says, yeah, we need a real job too. We don't get paid for being members of parliament. There was a time when a member of parliament didn't get paid. He got a free train ticket to go up to Pretoria. He didn't get, or come down to Cape Town's case maybe. Like our teacher, he got a free train ticket to go to Salisbury. If he wanted to fly, it's on his own account. He couldn't often afford the time to go by train, so he'd often have to fly. So he is actually paying for being a member of parliament. He wasn't effectively getting paid because about the only benefits he got wasn't always a benefit. It's like when we were in the South African Army, we'd be given a free train ticket to go home on pass. But you only got 2.5 days pass to get to Cape Town. So you could spend most of the time going on the train there and back, so we'd hitchhike. So, you know, it's just this sort of thing. Well, we can give you a free train ticket, but anything else, you're an expense. So, but that's the way it used to be with Parliament. Do you know there was a time when we had Smuts as a Prime Minister, there were 5 cabinet ministers in the whole of South Africa. 5 cabinet ministers. Today, are we 50 or 60? Are we 72? I've lost track. It's way over the 50 mark. We used to have 5 cabinet ministers. They were the only full-time employees of elected representatives. All the other members of Parliament had to have real jobs. And of course, that meant Parliament only met for a few weeks of the year. They had to do real work the rest of the time. And in fact, that's good, because the longer these idiots stay in Parliament, the more trouble they make for the rest of us, and the more taxes we've got to pay, and the more their salaries. And it's bizarre. Keep government miniature. I like that idea of bring taxes down to below 1%. Bring government down to its normal thing. Bring the country down to local level. Decentralize everything. Who cares about central government? What have they ever done for us? Western Cape exit and all that. Good. Any other comments or questions?
Back to Notre Dame.
Yes.
I understand why the Roman Catholics have St. Mary, as they call her, in the church and everything. But why, like, on the roof and around the sides, do they have, like, weird, I don't suppose you can even call them creatures?
Oh, demons. Yes. Yeah. Yes, indeed. That is, that's very interesting. I didn't get to those pictures. I must do a bit on it. By the way, here's my notes of tonight. Notre Dame Cathedral, which has got more than what I was able to put in, because this only just finished this late this afternoon. So you can imagine, I had something else planned for tonight, but when I saw about this, and the more I looked into it, the more I saw this really big story. I think this will be for Europe like 9/11 was for America. Wow. Pre-post. This heralds a whole new different dimension. And the battle now is going to be, will they rebuild the Notre Dame as an interfaith, as Chrislam or secular temple or what? Who knows where they're going? Because the architecture said things that's hard to change. But if you destroy it and you can rebuild, will they rebuild to the original specs like they did in Germany after the bombings, rebuilding to exactly the same, or will they do something different? Knowing the French, they're probably going to do something pretty different. So, but France is so gone spiritually. If they had Marine Le Pen, it would be different because she's a French nationalist. But Macron, what a disaster. Has anyone noticed that every single leader of Western Europe right now is a childless person? They might be married, but none of them have any children. Not May, not Macron, not Merkel, nor the character who's running Ireland or the Scottish one and a whole bunch of others. It's just, they've got all these childless leaders. They've got no investment in the future. I mean, they don't have any children or grandchildren to care about. Like, so what if they sell it down the river? But I've got more than that. Yes, so why did the cathedral have all these demons all the way around? They call them gargoyles. They look like demons. And they said the reason was because the water pouring out, the vast roof area catches a lot of rain. And it would come out, it sounded like gargoyles. And so they call them gargoyles because of the funny sound it made coming out. And they decided to shape them looking like demons, suggesting, this is one of the descriptions of it, that the gargoyles or the demons around the church symbolize the fact that the church is in a hostile world surrounded by demons. And so they had the demons on the outside, and then they had the statues of the saints and the apostles and the biblical kings and Virgin Mary and all this. So basically it was like, we need the protection of the church to protect us from the demons out there. I still find it strange why you'd have demonic figures on the outside of a cathedral, but that's what they said.
Is it true that they were removed before the fire?
Oh, this is another fascinating thing. I've got also from intelligence friends in Europe just today telling me that strikingly most of the real treasures, if not all of them, were removed during the time of renovation. And they believe that this could be part of an insurance scam. They might try to claim more on insurance for things that were lost that might not have been lost, that now could be sold in the black market. There's all kinds of... If this is a planned false flag, you can imagine some people deciding, well, I might as well make a few tens of millions of euros on the side. So, but there was a lot of it that was not even there. And so much... So the damage actually was less than it could have been because of the renovation at the time, but the renovation might have been the cover to bring in the arson.
Now, if the government's got two-thirds and the Catholic Church running the third,
yes,
with that being moved out, there must be some procedure.
Okay, here's the next suspicion. The next serious suspicion about this is that there was a lot of embarrassment about the costs of renovating. There's been, in fact, whole documentaries, including by the BBC, I was looking at some of them just last night, talking about the vast cost of a lot of the stonework is eroding and the lead roof very heavy and pressing down and causing damage on a lot of the stonework. It's got lead in the roof and it's got oak. Now, this needed multiplied hundreds of millions to be put into to properly restore it. So, it could have been both a false flag and an insurance scam, and a way of suddenly, we were going to come up with all this money. Well, if we have a fire, then we can have an insurance scam. When I was in the fire brigade, one of the first fires I ever went to was actually a five fire engine fire in Epping, Industria. And as you'd get gotten, you could smell the fuel. It was a food, it was a shoe factory run by a Muslim, which was doing badly. You know, the next thing had fun. One thing we noticed was there's very few shoes in the place. They must have shipped out a lot of action. Anyway, it was proven through the forensics this was an awesome false flag insurance scam. They got nothing from insurance. They went to jail. I mean, that was very bad. And of course, you know, firemen tend to get very angry about putting out a fire when it was self-started. So there's no doubt that this was going to get reported and all the rest. And there was a lot of fury over this. But an insurance fire solves a lot of your problems, especially if you take a lot of your assets, movable assets, out first, and then you claim on all of it. So I think this is, from all accounts, it could easily be terrorism, but it's more likely that it's a false flag, which can be, and the fact that they've ruled out terrorism, it means they don't want anything to disrupt the continuing multicultural Islam invasion, all that sort of thing. And it could also be the goal that we're going to change this embarrassingly too Christian cathedral into something more secular and more multicultural interfaith, which is a strong possibility. Of course, will the French people resist and fight this? I'm interested to see how this is going to go, but I think this for Europe, this is the biggest icon. If you could imagine, I don't think we've got anything here to compare.
I've been there. Amazed. I mean, not that. You can look at a piece of brick and you'll stand in amazement of the workmanship, but you cannot believe the craftsmanship. I'm not worried about all the statues and all that. No. That wasn't my concern.
It's architecture.
But the architecture is just magnificent. And yes, there is nothing in the world like, I mean, I spent there 3 hours, but I was so disturbed by everything around me.
We don't have anything like that to compare here because we've got multi nations and cultures and religions here. But for the French people, Notre Dame represents not just Paris but France.
Yes,
and
it does.
It's the symbol of, it's the identity of the people, it's the most permanent building in the country and all the rest of it. So the attack on that. There is nothing to compare. You couldn't look at any building in America that has that, even. Now, in Britain, if you went for the House of Parliament, and the House of Parliament's only been around for 200 years. In fact, it was built in the time of Queen Victoria. It's less than 200 years old. Westminster Abbey's been around for 900 years. Now, Westminster Abbey would be pretty serious. But Westminster Abbey's not even quite as big. Notre Dame's bigger. And it's even more important. Westminster Abbey's Notre Dame's more important to France than Westminster Abbey is to Britain. Westminster Abbey's very important because Britain, for example, London, they've also got the St. Paul's, which is only dating back to the 1660s anyway. The present structure, because the original one was destroyed in 1666. So. But even then, if there was an attack on that, I don't know that that would have the same impact. This is such a major icon for France, I can only imagine that you're going to see a huge difference in everything coming out of this. And because they've got such a wicked government, Macron's government is evil. I wouldn't put it past them. And the first reports I've got from, I don't know if these intelligence people have given me the best, but they've claimed that this is definitely inside job, false flag, French government involved. In the same report, they were saying that Macron is part of the international satanic paedophilia ring and all the rest of it, which is not hard to believe. And he's so super popular, he came from nowhere. And the media just loved him, and he got into power just like that when everyone thought that Marine Le Pen was heading in for victory. And they twisted out of their hand through very uncouth media dirty tricks and probably fraud at the election poll. But Macron's obviously a crown prince in the New World Order. And they've got some real evil plans as a result of this.
I think the Catholic link with them as well, if it's not arson, if it's not a terrorist attack.
Well, it's definitely arson terrorist attack. The point is it done by an outside influence or by the French government itself?
But I think if it's internal, it's
very likely.
Together with the Catholic Church.
Oh, it could be, because what does the Catholic Church get out of it?
Yes.
Phew. They don't have to pay those hundreds of millions that they need to for renovations, because insurance will cover it. So, yes, for the Catholic Church, it could be a real relief, because they have not been doing all the maintenance they should have been doing, and there's a lot of it's just... In fact, even in Britain they've got, and in America, Save Notre Dame campaigns. And if you go on the internet, there's videos on it, the BBC going around, and you can see there's massive... look at the rose windows, which looks great from far. A lot of it's crumbling, and a lot of the stonework and this and that. And there's a major amount of work that had to be done. And the French government's saying, well, we'll only pay for 2/3. You've got to pay for 1/3. And the church saying, oh, we don't have money and all this nonsense. So now you're going to get people donating Catholic faithful from all over the world towards this. And you get people out of France and the insurance companies. This is a windfall for them. And if you're just thinking of it in terms of money, who don't care about the history and the things that are lost. So it probably was that in the report I got today, which again was from a Canadian intelligence source who said he was actually there when it happened and saw the whole thing and said this was definitely a cover-up, the way the French police had cordoned off the area and prevented everything. He claimed in this report two people were found dead with gunshot wounds to the back of the head inside where this happened, and believed that they were church people who probably didn't want to go along with it or who discovered what was going on. These things will come out clearer in the next few days, but this is the immediate reports. We only start getting these reports late Monday. So this is only 3 days of research. I've come up with this much, and I think it's a lot more than that.
But what if this is not a bad sign? What if this is a good sign? What if this is a turning point in people looking back to Christianity as the answer?
That's not impossible. Certainly that's what we must work on, is saying Notre Dame has been hijacked for a long time by false religion, with empty religion, with idolatry, and so on, and now it's been damaged by evil, either secular or Islamist forces. But the whole timing of this, everything, it's an anti-Christian agenda. If people can get this picture, that would immediately wake up a lot of people. And a French person, if they realise their government has done this, I think a French person would be furious. Absolutely blood-red furious. I mean, how could you ever forgive a government that did that to you? And the government's obviously lying to the people. Just the fact that they could rule out, before they've done forensics, arson, they covered something major up if they could do that. It's so premature. How can you give such a statement while the fire's still burning? It's never been done that I can recall.
The French are emotional now. They're not thinking logically, they're thinking emotionally.
Well, so if you could direct them with a bit of information.
But that's what I'm saying is, if this can be turned around to not what history repeats itself all the time, all these churches in France, all over the world, that would be major for Christianity.
To wake up people, just for people to realize the church is under attack. It's been under attack for years in Africa and the Middle East.
Yes.
From Islam and communism, we know that. It's been subverted and hijacked by Western secularism for many years and false ministers. But if you can now realize the church is physically, well, it's obviously physically under attack, you can see this. And if you don't accept the eye wash of that this is an accident, then one says, why is the government lying to us? So, yes, this could be a way of bringing the House of Cards down. That's why I thought it was worthwhile to just redirect where I was wanting to focus tonight on the greatest crime in history, which is, of course, the betrayal, trial, execution of Christ, the only good person ever walked this earth. But when I saw the church on text, I thought, okay, well, we have to move this on because this is news right now, and I think we've got to get our minds in gear because Satan's done a major attack, and God's allowed it. And what's he saying through this?